From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, in the wake of the deadly explosion in the town of West, should Texas tighten the regulations of fertilizer factories in the state? And the Keystone XL pipeline, will it bring jobs and prosperity to East Texas or an environmental disaster waiting to happen? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was on Wednesday night that the Texas town of West was rocked by a massive explosion at the Adair Grain DBA West Fertilizer Company. About 54,000 pounds of the liquid nitrogen fertilizer was on site when the fire broke out. The local volunteer fire department showed up to fight the blaze, and about 25 minutes later, the explosion happened. It's being called one of the worst industrial accidents in U.S. history. A middle school across the street is severely damaged. Homes in a half-mile radius destroyed. Other homes and businesses across town damaged. The number of dead and injured, still unknown. And there are so many other unknowns. Did the brave volunteer first responders know the risk of explosion when they answered that fateful call? Had they been given the proper information about not spraying water on that chemical fire, could state regulations have prevented this disaster? The Texas Commission on Environmental Quality is the lead agency in regulating events like in West. According to the TCEQ, the Adair Fertilizer Company was built in 1962. Before there were state and federal requirements to obtain authorization for emission of air contaminants. As a result, this facility was grandfathered until state law required grandfathered facilities to obtain authorization. That happened in 2006 after a local citizen's complaint of the noxious smell of ammonia coming from the plant. The TCEQ investigated and issued a notice of violation. The first air permit was issued later that year. The town of West was given a chance for public comment and to contest the case, but no one came forward in opposition. 4 months later, a second permit was issued, and again the town was asked to comment and contest the permit, but no one came forward and voiced opposition. The residents of West today say they had no idea of the potential for disaster at the fertilizer plant that was right next door. In a YouTube video of a West couple driving through the town immediately after the explosion, they are stunned looking at the damage, and they speculate what could have caused this destruction. They wonder if it was a meteor strike. Maybe it was a plane crash or a meth lab explosion.
Is that a plane?
I don't know.
Really, what is it?
I don't know.
It's a plane.
I don't even recognize. I have no idea where I am.
That had to have been a plane. What else could it have been?
I don't know. That's no meth lab.
The local fertilizer plant was thought to be so safe that it wasn't even considered. Federal regulations also appear to have been unable to prevent this disaster. In 2006, the EPA fined the plant's owners $2,300 for failing to have a risk management assessment that met federal standards. Adair West Fertilizer then certified they had corrected the problem and that there was no risk of fire or explosion, and according to reporting by the Dallas Morning News, the owners said the worst-case scenario would be a short release of ammonia gas that would not cause any deaths or injuries. And records reviewed by the Associated Press show the U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration fined Adair West Fertilizer $10,000 last summer for safety violations. The inspector found the company was transporting the fertilizer without a security plan and that the plant's ammonia tanks were not properly labeled. How many more potentially explosive fertilizer plants are out there in Texas, surrounded by homes, schools, and nursing homes? In Texas, when it comes to monitoring, regulating, and inspecting facilities like the Adair West Fertilizer Company, it's the job of the TCEQ. But their focus is on air quality and not for the potential of a catastrophic explosion. Neil Carman is a former inspector for the TCEQ and says the agency is unable to keep up with the need for inspections.
I was a field investigator, and so I went to over 200 industrial plants a year, most of them major sources under the Clean Air Act versus minor sources. Many of these fertilizer plants are regulated, or I say not really regulated, but they're minor sources because the emissions tend to be so low.
So you would inspect these fertilizer manufacturing facilities similar to the one in West, but you never actually went to West?
No, not that one. They tend to be smaller plants with, you know, I don't know how large this one was, but, you know, typically these plants don't have a lot of emissions, even this large one, but the agency would give a permit for the ammonia storage tanks, in this case anhydrous ammonia. This plant, it said, had two very large, highly pressurized anhydrous ammonia storage tanks.
This is not the only one of these facilities in Texas. But about how many of them do you think there are?
There could be maybe a dozen or more. It wouldn't be a huge number, but the emission data that these plants would have wouldn't even be in the emission inventory for the big industrial plants, because it's not the emissions are so low that you wouldn't find it reportable in either the state's major source, point source emission inventory, or even in the EPA's, the Environmental Protection Agency's Toxic Release Inventory Center, because the TRI data requires certain thresholds, and I would suspect that this plant, there's no data in the EPA's TRI system because this plant has such low toxic releases. And ammonia may even be exempt from any toxic release reporting.
Talk about how these facilities are regulated in the sense of they blow up, right? I mean, saw.
Yes, there was one that.
So that
blew
to
up.
Me, that seems to be more the biggest problem than the air quality.
Well, there was another fertilizer plant, I believe, that blew up near Bryan College Station just about 5 years ago. Now, that one was far enough away, and it was a fire, and they were able to evacuate people. I don't believe anybody was killed or injured. But in this case, this plant is right in the neighborhood, and fortunately, if there's any blessing, I think it happened late at night or in the evening, so there were no kids at the elementary school, or many of those children might have died.
And the school was directly across the street from the facility.
Yeah, I mean, this is an example of very bad siting where, you know, we learned in the 1980s with the disaster in India, at Bhopal, India, where an estimated 10,000 people were killed from a leak of a toxic chemical. And so we adopted through the Congress in the 1980s regulations and reporting on the potential for chemical disasters. Well, we haven't learned our lesson, because this plant never should have been located in a community. It should be, you can see a mile away from wherever anybody lives.
We are not able to get information at this time from the TCEQ, the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, of where all the other fertilizer manufacturing facilities are in Texas. I mean, people need to know where these things are.
They can pull it up in their databases, but this is not, it's not publicly available yet. I have access to some databases, but this plant, I can look in one of the databases I have. It won't even show up in the primary. If you look at the database for very large plants like refineries, chemical plants, power plants, and so forth, you won't even see these small fertilizer plants listed because it's a minor source, and they don't put I'm going to check right now, but I've never seen them listed in there.
If you have a facility like this near your neighborhood, people need to know that.
Yes, absolutely.
And there needs to be some sort of government involvement in regulating these facilities to prevent another tragic explosion that will devastate a town like we're seeing in West.
Yeah, this is not listed on the TCQ's big, it's the major plants or large industrial plants, annual emission inventory. It doesn't even show up. It won't, because they've got some other plants there, some power plants and a gasoline terminal or a large storage terminal for fuel, but it doesn't even show up, and none of them will in this.
But obviously, fertilizer, we know, is a very volatile substance. We know that from Texas City, the explosion that happened there back in the 40s.
Yes.
So how come more isn't done to at least keep an eye on these?
It's an example of having gaps and loopholes in our regulatory system. And this is a very good example of, you know, if the plant had been built someplace else, maybe the, you know, workers would be, you know, harmed, but not the community. And so this is just another example of...
Well, but the plant has been there for 50 years.
Well, then there should have been some kind of zoning around it, but, you know, that... So basically it's left up to the local...
So it was really up to the local school board that put the school right next to the plant.
The school board and also the city fathers, okay? They thought there was nothing wrong. The plant's been there 50 years, but, you know, there could have been federal and state regulations that, well, you can't build anything within a quarter of a mile of this plant or even, you know, a half a mile. But, you know, in these urban areas, cities, even the small towns, they want to be able to use this land. Okay. So it's a real problem that we have. And
not just in Texas, but across the nation.
Yes. I mean, I've seen other siting problems where an older existing small industrial plant, they're building schools nearby, and apartments and homes, and then people find out, oh, we're next to a toxic source, and then you've got a problem because the industrial factory doesn't want to move, and it doesn't want to add air pollution control equipment. This plant, obviously, was not very... most of these kinds of accidents are caused by human errors. Even if you've got problems with the equipment, if they properly inspected and maintained their equipment, they would not have these accidents. This is what we find when the accident investigations are conducted, and oops, they should have changed this piece of equipment out. They should have done some maintenance on it. They should have fixed the leaks, and they didn't. And then you have accidents. So, I mean, the plant has been there for 50 years without having an accident. So most of these kinds of accidents are due to human error.
What about fighting the fire at this plant with water? I understand that water and this ammonia is not a good combination.
No. So you have to have special chemicals that can kind of suppress the fire. It's difficult. And obviously this town probably has no firefighting equipment to handle such a fire.
It's a volunteer fire department. It doesn't look like they had been trained in order to deal with what could go wrong at this facility.
Exactly. And this is another dilemma with our, even though the plant is supposed to report some of the hazardous materials it has there on site, the volunteer fire department probably had very minimal training about, the accident, fire explosion potential from this fertilizer plant.
So you're a former inspector for the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. You've been to these places. Is enough being done to make sure the regulations that are in place are being enforced?
I don't think so. The two fertilizer plants that used ammonia that I inspected were relatively small and probably much smaller than this one. And people did complain about ammonia odors, and the agency did issue several violations for nuisance odors because they had leaks that they had to fix. And they did have permits, but these were pretty small facilities, and we did not inspect them, I think, every year.
Neil Carman is a former inspector for the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. After the explosion of the West Fertilizer Factory, he says the TCEQ is unable to adequately inspect other potentially explosive factories across the state. Building the controversial Keystone XL pipeline has hit a roadblock in Texas. But is it a temporary delay in the massive project, or is it the end of the line for the pipeline that could carry the petroleum product of the Canadian tar sands to the refineries in Port Arthur, Texas? On Thursday, the State Department held what might be the last of the public hearings on the pipeline. Hundreds of anti-pipeline activists took part in the Grand Island, Nebraska hearing. If approved, the pipeline would have to cross East Texas, where protesters are looking to stop the project. Jerry Hightower is one of those protesters. He's also part of a longtime local farming family.
Actually, that pipeline comes through our family farm.
What have you been doing? How have you been protesting this?
Ended up in D.C. is my real only action that I've gotten arrested doing. I went to Washington, D.C., and locked myself to the White House gate along with 47 other individuals just to have our voices heard. And I believe my voice was heard, but I don't believe it has stopped any pipelines. I'm actually opposed to the tar sand project as a whole. It's not just this particular pipeline or the other particular pipelines they choose to send it through. I, like many others, feel that the tar sand project as a whole, the extraction of it in Alberta, Canada, and now the extraction of it that's occurring in, I believe, Utah, it's deplorable stuff. Everybody that has looked at it has said it's not good for anything except for a handful of rich people to get richer. I don't see that it's going to create any kind of energy independence for our country. It won't refine down into a good enough fuel for us to use in our country by our fuel standards.
There are lots of pipelines, and we're seeing that they don't always behave according to plan. We're seeing what's happening in Arkansas, not that far from where you are, where the Mayflower pipeline has ruptured.
Actually, the Mayflower pipeline, when it leaves Arkansas, it comes through and crosses Highway 37 about a mile and a half from our farm. It's about a mile away from our farm where the Keystone XL and the Pegasus pipeline cross each other. I have stood at the intersection and seen where they cross each other.
Well, the Mayflower pipeline has caused quite a mess up in Arkansas. And can you imagine if that had happened near your farm?
Well, what I can see is they're washing it out of the neighborhoods to where it doesn't look so bad to the public eye, and they're washing it down into the creek bottoms. Our family farm, half or more of it is creek bottoms that is downhill from both the Pegasus pipeline and the Keystone XL. So if either of those were to rupture there at the highway, I can see now from what they've done there, I know that they're just going to pressure wash it down into our creek bottoms, out of our front yard and into our creek bottoms, therefore into the lake. Put out plenty of floating barricades, but this is not a crude oil we're talking about. This is not something that floats on top of the water. This is something that's going to sink. They try to call it heavy crude, but that's just for tax purposes and legal purposes. What just happened in Arkansas is TransCanada's worst nightmare since the protest has been going on. Also, the government just released their environmental impact study, which we were all hoping would say, look, this stuff is deplorable, it will kill everything. That's what the NASA scientists were saying. Said it would be the end of mankind as we know it, from a NASA scientist. And their environmental impact study came together from their handpicked group of people, and it said that this stuff is all right. It's just fine. It won't adversely affect anything. And then to see this spill in Arkansas 2 days after they said, oh, this isn't going to hurt anything, Well, I bet if you walk around in those creek bottoms, you'll see all kinds of hurt stuff.
Jerry Hightower is an East Texas farmer and is opposed to the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. National environmental organizations are also opposed to the XL pipeline. This week, Public Citizen issued a report that claims the pipeline would actually increase gas prices and reduce national energy security. Tyson Slocum is a researcher for Public Citizen.
We released research that found that gasoline exports are currently leading to higher gasoline prices of as much as 10 cents or 12 cents a gallon for a national average. In addition, we found that the Keystone Pipeline, because its express intent is to move the processing of Canadian tar sands oil away from the Midwestern United States to the Gulf Coast, where the refiners there are oriented towards exporting refined products, means that the Keystone Pipeline will increase the level of exports and therefore amplify the price increase impact that we're currently seeing due to the current level of exports. And third, we took a look at where that potential export market is likely to be, which is China. And that explains the explicit reasoning of entities controlled by the national government of China in increasing direct investment into tar sands production. And therefore, we think that that undercuts Keystone Pipeline proponents' arguments that the pipeline is designed to improve U.S. energy security. We believe that this pipeline is more about Canadian interests and to serve Canadian interests in getting landlocked Canadian oil to a global market, not just a U.S. market. And that global market is increasingly dominated by Chinese interests. And that explains the significant level of direct Chinese investment in the Canadian tar sands.
Tyson Slocum is a researcher for Public Citizen, and he's opposed to the Tar Sands XL pipeline. After that interview, I did make contact with a supporter of the pipeline with the group Consumer Energy Alliance. Michael Watley is the executive vice president for the group.
Well, I will say first and foremost that Keystone XL will absolutely not raise gasoline prices. You know, we're talking about a pipeline with a capacity to bring 830,000 barrels of oil into the U.S. markets from the Bakken reserves that are in North Dakota, Montana, South Dakota, as well as Canadian oil sands. And those reserves right now are running anywhere from $30 to $50 a barrel cheaper than the oil that we're bringing in from the Middle East on boats. And so if you are going to either replace that more expensive oil or bring in additional reserves on top of that oil, the law of supply and demand is pretty clear. We're going to get lower prices. And, you know, given that gasoline prices at the pump are dictated exclusively on a direct peg with gasoline prices or with crude oil prices, you know, when we reduce the price of the oil that goes in at the refinery gate, we're going to reduce the prices at the pump. So that is the main reason that Consumer Energy Alliance so strongly supports this. You know, the other key factors that we're going to get out of it are that the Obama administration estimates that this pipeline is going to create 47,000 jobs in a time where we have chronic unemployment. That's a huge number. It's a very critical number for us. And these are not low-paying jobs. These are not minimum wage jobs. These are very high-paying, skilled, you know, contractors that are going to be able to help take the dollars that they earn on this thing and put it out through the U.S. economy. In fact, the last analysis by the administration said that this would put $20 billion into the U.S. economy on a privately funded project.
Now, Mr. Watley, the Public Citizen and their narrative and how they arrive at their conclusion that the pipeline would increase gas prices, they're saying that this is a product that is being created to sell, to export mainly to China, where fuel prices could be higher.
Well, I'll tell you this, that if you want to export oil to China, the way you do it is you take a pipeline straight from the Canadian oil sands deposits over to the Pacific coast, load it on a supertanker, and then send it over to China. The last thing you're going to do is put it onto a 1,700-mile pipeline, ship it down to the Gulf Coast refineries, put it on a tanker that's not a super tanker, and then send it through the Suez or through the Panama Canal over to China, which is going to cost you a fortune in shipping costs, both through the pipeline and on shipping for it. So it's far more likely to go to China if we don't build the pipeline than if we do. The other main consideration is that right now, again, the oil that will come through this pipeline is dramatically cheaper than the oil that we're bringing in from the Middle East. And the last thing that any company is going to do is export cheap product and import expensive product, particularly when we're dealing with commodities like crude oil.
Now, about those job numbers that you had, they say that those are for the construction jobs, but once the pipeline is completed, then there are very few jobs available.
Well, I got to say, 47,000 jobs, even if they're construction jobs, are very real jobs. The construction timeline is going to take 2 years. And we've been spending a lot of time with labor folks and the pipeline unions here that strongly support this project. And if you tell them that their jobs are temporary, they'll say that they want them anyway. These are real jobs. These are American jobs. And when we're looking at a chronically high unemployment rate, why in the world anybody would criticize a job, even if it's temporary, is beyond me.
Now, I've also heard reported that y'all say that the XL pipeline is going to be the safest pipeline ever built. But people are pulling up photographs and images from the spill in the Mayflower spill in Arkansas and saying this could happen here. So how do we respond to that?
Well, I would say this, any oil spill is bad, and we do not want oil spills. But, the advances that we've seen in pipeline safety since that pipeline was built in the 1940s are truly amazing. And the pipeline advances that that TransCanada has agreed to, in addition to being state-of-the-art and up to the regs that are required by the Pipeline and Hazardous Material Safety Administration, they've agreed to an additional 57 safety considerations on top of what current law and regulations require. So there's no question that it is going to be the safest pipeline ever built. And we would argue that we need to have the advances in the infrastructure to make sure that we have these pipelines built in the safest way. And certainly the alternative, how are you going to get this oil to the U.S. market if not by pipeline? It would come in by train or truck or barge, all of which are exponentially more likely to have leaks or spills than pipelines.
So where are we in the process of trying to get the pipeline greenlit? What's the holdup right now?
Well, right now the Department of State is analyzing TransCanada's pipeline permit application. They need to get a presidential permit because the pipeline crosses the international border from Canada into the United States. And the department has prepared a draft supplemental environmental impact statement, which is an environmental review. And we are in Grand Island, Nebraska today, testifying at a public hearing that they're holding, and they're accepting public comments on the draft environmental review through Monday. And once they finish this review, then they'll finalize the environmental review, and then they will have to make a determination on whether or not the pipeline is in the national interest. And we hope that that will happen sometime this summer or maybe this fall.
Michael Watley is Executive Vice President for the Consumer Energy Alliance, which supports the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can send emails about the program to texasmatters@tpr.org. We've got past Texas Matters programs that you can listen to on our website at tpr.org. And you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.